podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
Welcome, everyone, to the DIA podcast. My name is Sudhit Parikh, and I have the privilege of leading DIA's activities in the Americas. I'm not your usual host for a DIA podcast, but when I learned that today's guest was going to be Ellen Siegel, I really had to do the interview myself. Ellen Siegel is the chairperson and founder of Friends of Cancer Research, otherwise known as FRIENDS. FRIENDS is an advocacy organization based here in Washington, D.C., that drives collaboration among partners from every part of the healthcare sector to drive advances in science, policy, and regulation with the goal of getting life-saving treatments to patients. And it's a patient advocacy organization that really understands policy. Over the past 20 years, FRIENDS has been instrumental to the creation and implementation of policies that you've all heard of and made use of. Policies, including things like breakthrough therapies, really ensure that patients receive the best treatments in the fastest and safest possible way. You started Friends of Cancer Research 22 years ago. What's most different today about cancer research and policy versus what you found when you first started Friends?
It's very different. First of all, we've advanced the science. We now are really, truly in the age of personalized medicine. And although 22 years ago, we certainly knew cancer wasn't one disease, but now the opportunities to execute and to really get better treatments to patients are really here. And I think advocacy has become more sophisticated. Advocacy always starts with passion and urgency, but today the advocacy community is much more focused on deliverables and in making changes to the system that will benefit patients. So the world is very, very different. And I also think what's very different today is that the voice of the patient is important. 20, 25 years ago, there were always patients, but essentially they didn't really have a very big voice other than caring deeply about treatments. But today, it's more than lip service today. Patient-reported outcomes, working with patients, the voice, the passion of the patient is real, and what they contribute to clinical trials, what they contribute to the science, and what they want is really much more than tokenism. And I think 20 years ago or 25 years ago, that was very nascent. It's a very different world today.
When you started, a lot of times you were advocating for biomedical research funding. So you were thinking about appropriations for the National Cancer Institute or for other parts of the government. Over that 22 years, you've really evolved into thinking about policy and regulation. How did that happen?
My story starts, of course, with the personal tragedy and loss of my sister, but I cared deeply about research funding because even 25 years ago or 30 years ago when my sister died, I knew we didn't have the answers to save patients, and the only way that we were going to get there was through research. So essentially, my passion was, still is, finding answers, finding treatments for patients, and continuing the knowledge and the research was really incredibly important. But at some point, I realized that our advocacy, although very meaningful about research, and it still is important because we still don't have the answers, and the science and the funding of science is crucial. I became very interested in the regulatory environment and policy that impacts cancer. It almost was a happenstance. We all in those days understood there was a regulatory environment, but didn't know very much about what it did. And many of us were angry, but we didn't know exactly how to fix it, or we didn't know why. And it started with kind of understanding policy and science at the regulatory environment, how it was organized. And I spent about a year, along with many people in the community, studying drug approval in cancer and how it really happens. And it was clearly almost irrational. It didn't make any sense. And we worked together as a community to go to the director of the FDA and say, look, we need more seamless, not only funding, but we needed people in a program that really was going to meet the needs of patients, and the organizational structure wasn't conducive to really getting the results that we needed. And I, at some point, understood that research was important, but unless it got to the patient and unless the regulatory environment understood what the needs are and the science and could translate it, it wasn't really going to help patients. So it was really the genesis of going from appropriations to understanding ultimately patients won't benefit if they don't get the treatments that will help them.
Ellen, you and Friends had a lot to do with the breakthrough therapies designation and all that's come from that. What was the genesis of that idea?
The genesis of our work at Friends really started with collaboration and working closely with the regulatory agency and all the stakeholders on what could we do better, what can we do different. So the first step was clearly the organization of cancer at the agency, and that was what we started 10 years ago. But we worked very closely with Rick Pazder and the agency to see what can we solve, what can we work on together. And Breakthrough was an idea that came from both Jenna Woodcock and Rick Pazder. And the question to us when we were doing one of our annual forums with the agency, the question was, what should we do when we see early important results of a trial? What should the agency do? It seemed very obvious, but it wasn't obvious. It was very difficult, and we worked with all stakeholders on trying to figure out what the solution was, and we worked with statisticians, and we worked with other patient groups and academics and other people within the regulatory environment, and it was hard to come up with an answer. It seemed obvious, well, of course you should accelerate, but what do you need? What does substantial mean? You know, what is unmet need? What can happen? Is this ready? And we worked very closely with all the stakeholders, including the FDA. And it was very clear that there were opportunities to accelerate treatments to patients that were going to be very worthwhile and very important to them. And when we finally had consensus that everyone felt an urgency to do this, we thought it was an opportunity to bring it to Congress. And initially, people said, well, I don't understand. The agency can do this anyway. And it's not clear whether they could or not. What was clear is we needed a new infrastructure, we needed priority, and we needed regulation that basically said this is important. And what we didn't recognize then, and we recognize now, is it changed culture. The PDUFA legislation that enabled Breakthrough allowed the agency to have an all-hands-on-deck approach to it. It engaged companies and academics and the National Cancer Institute and others to design their trials differently. And it had a mechanism at the agency that allowed them to act very quickly when they saw opportunity. So we were shocked. We had expected maybe one or two drugs a year, and we thought they'd all be in cancer. No one understood that we'd have now, as of January, 68 breakthrough therapies that have been approved, about 603 requests and 210 designations. So what it did is the statute changed culture in the agency, outside of the agency, and it changed the way we design trials. And the most important thing is it's benefited patients to get better treatments. And that's what ultimately the goal is.
I think it's also raised the profile of FDA in Washington with Congress and other political leaders, because it's given them something to understand about FDA, that they do prioritize things that are important to patients. It's really made the agency, I hesitate to say more popular, but really more popular with Congress.
I think that's true. I think many people, including some of the patient groups in the early days and companies and others, looked at the agency as a barrier, and they didn't recognize, well, first of all, the science was evolving, but the agency wanted to get better treatments out to patients, and they wanted the ability to work collaboratively and to get out of their silos. And it was really a breakthrough, although we're very proud of it at Friends, and we played a very major role, but it wouldn't have happened without Janet Woodcock and Rick Pazder and the Congress understanding this is important. And you're right, it's given a lot of visibility and credit to the agency, which is well deserved, but it also took other stakeholders to say, we need to design our trials better. We need to be able to look at trials that are going to be meaningful and have really important results to patients. So it really did change culture. And I agree, the agency, through the lens of Congress and maybe even patient groups, particularly those with really, really lethal diseases or with where there was unmet medical need, were very frustrated. And now people are excited and they know that they have an agency that's ready. If the data is there and it's going to make a difference and it's going to really enhance the lives and it has efficacy, people are willing to get it out to patients. And I give the agency enormous credit for it. And it's very exciting. And ultimately, the most important beneficiary clearly are the patients.
More current is the reorganization that you also help port in the agency around the Oncology Center of Excellence, an idea of really organizing the agency around disease state. And it's one that I think other leaders in the agency have taken up. How did you see that as being beneficial to patients, the creation of OCE?
Patients don't get a diagnostic or a drug or a vaccine. They get a disease. And our work early on, 10 years ago, when we started the reorganization and elevation of the Agency of Cancer to an integrated program and elevated it from a division to an office, started then. And it was very clear with the complexity today of science that the ability to work together to integrate vaccines, biologics, antibodies, diagnostics, working together was really the only way this was going to really advance the science, because the silos of having a diagnostic that works are highly dependent on having a drug and a biologic that works together or in combination. And what the core of it was to really get people with a clinical expertise, the clinicians, certainly most of them at CDER, but some at CBER, to work together and to have the clinical sign-off, because the people that understood the natural history of a disease really have to be very involved in the decision-making. It may be that there were others that may understood vaccines or antibodies or diagnostics, but you have to understand the disease state that you're really designing this trial for and this treatment for. And it was crucial to understand, respect the different expertise of diagnostics and biologics, but drugs, but they had to work together to really accelerate treatment and to work as a team rather than to work in a silo, which accomplished nothing for a patient. It took too long, and you need people who understand the history of the disease and the clinical portion of it. So that's what was driving it. The science was there, and we had very good reception. It's very difficult to reorganize anything and traditional structures within an agency, but I think there was the ability to accept that this could be done was important, and I think we came up with a logical way to do this and as a model for other diseases, certainly. But ultimately, a patient gets a disease, and the diagnostic or the vaccine or the antibody really is there to help the patient with the disease. And understanding that disease and understanding how they're integrated and work together really is what's most important. And again, the whole point is to accelerate these treatments for patients so patients get the best opportunity to have an intervention for their disease.
Do you feel like, and I certainly get a sense of this, that the science has really developed rapidly, the regulation and the regulatory agencies have evolved rapidly, and the advocacy has evolved rapidly, such that there's almost a convergence of progress in all those areas that you really feel, there's almost a feeling of momentum in the cancer research field. Do you feel that, or is that my imagination?
No, I will tell you it's tangible. 10, 15 years ago, when we started really looking at the regulatory environment, there was a lot of anger. Too fast, too slow, not scientific. There was this idea that the agency was an enormous barrier. I think now, almost universally, it's just shocking. I hear no complaints or few complaints. I hear they're getting it done. They get it. They understand. So sectors that were pretty cynical or angry or felt that things weren't moving quickly now, or they're struggling to keep up. I often find that sometimes even the companies and the clinicians who are designing these trials don't understand what the agency is willing to accept and what their role is. And I have found even lung maps, we have very rare populations, and it's very, very difficult to get answers. And they've been willing to accept single-arm trials, and they get it. They understand. And they're looking for rigor. They're not looking for shortcuts. And nobody is looking to give patients treatments that won't work. I mean, they have to have efficacy. And patients, even in fatal diseases, want something that is likely to work. But I think this idea of collaborating and accelerating and working together, so it's interesting. It's shocking, because 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there were just complaints. And I also think that the leadership at FDA has to be given a lot of credit. Number one is it is a science agency, and people don't understand that, but they were seeking to get out of their silos and to get input and to work collaboratively with the other government agencies, to work with patients and to work with companies, because we're not going to get there and help patients unless everyone works together. And you have to go where the science is, and you have to work together. So it's a very different climate. And I'm not just being a cheerleader. I just get few, if any, complaints. I think people are having a hard time understanding that this is a time where we can make major changes to benefit patients.
And it has been a strong and steady leadership at the FDA and at the NIH through multiple administrations from both sides of the aisle, both parties, great leadership at those two agencies.
Great leadership, great ability to work collaboratively, but also passion. the patient community and the science community really were driven. I know the patients are smart. They know what they want. They're educated. They really are very passionate about working with these agencies towards better treatments.
With all that good news, there's still a lot to be done, and you're playing a leadership role in several organizations that are trying to make a difference, and really there are a lot of organizations trying to make a difference. You're the chair of the board of the Reagan-Udall Foundation. You're serving on the board of the Foundation for the NIH. You're on the board of governors for PCORI, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. I didn't even mention Vice President Biden's Moonshot Blue Ribbon Panel. The list goes on. I won't name everything. How do you see all these things working together and in concert to make progress?
Well, I think it's really important not to work in silos. I think each one has a very specific cause and it helps foster the science. So as an example, Reagan-Udall is by statute to really foster the science and public-private partnerships at the agency. It's not advisory, but it is to really have collaboration. So the fact that the agency can work in a silo without support from the community and without the ability to do partnerships is really important. The foundation for NIH is the same. The NIH is gifted, but clearly you need other voices, you need other collaborative projects where you bring in other stakeholders so that supports the work of the NIH. They couldn't do it without having these collaborations. It's crucial to support science, but it's also crucial to support collaborations. And the same thing for PCORI. What do patients want? What do the stakeholders want? What are the best treatments? What are the values that they care about? And they play a role in gathering information and having patient-centered research. This is new and really defining what it means. And all of them are set up by Congress. Certainly, PCORI came out of that. The Reagan-Udall statute came out of PDUFA. And the same thing with FNIH is longer and older, but the same concept, the idea is we work together. And they all overlap, but they have different functions.
What are your top priorities today?
The priority will always be to really help patients and get better treatments for patients and to really fast track the science and to make sure the science is really delivered to the regulatory bodies and that the advancement of the science really serves patients. Some of it is just basic science. We don't have all the answers and we're going to have to continue. So the essential work of the NIH and the support for funding for science is fundamental to the background of what we're doing. But to translate that work today and make sure we have a regulatory environment and a pharma environment and a patient environment that does everything humanly possible to get these treatments to patients is still the priority. I mean, we're doing master protocols. We care deeply about some structural issues that have been a problem. We can't do these one-off trials anymore. I mean, even in immunotherapy, we have enormous opportunities, but we have 20, 30 companies all trying to do the same thing. We have combination products, so prioritizing them, trying to encourage people to do master protocols, to really collaborate on foundational issues like biomarker development and things that will really benefit patients are important. So the idea that we're all working, whether individual companies or the NIH, in a vacuum can't happen anymore. So there just has to be a lot more collaboration and priority setting. So we are very interested in patient-reported outcomes. As an example, if a patient has a choice, well, what is my quality of life going to be? What are my choices going to be? If we have rare tumors, we're never going to get there without these master protocols. It's going to be absolutely crucial because today all these cancers are rare diseases. So the idea of companies working together and fostering these more efficient trials, and we don't need a lot of trials. We need better trials, and we have to think about what's important to patients. We're very interested in real-world data because what 3-5% of our patients really go on trials, but what can we get out of this big data? What does it mean? So those are issues that we're really thinking about, that we care about. We're interested in modernizing eligibility criteria for trials. Many patients are not allowed on trials, and we want to make sure that the eligibility is broad as possible. But we also want the patient voice in these trials. When we were redesigning LungMap trial, we gathered all the best people in the science and the companies, but the patient said, I'm willing to take two biopsies. Well, this eligibility criteria isn't broad enough. this is what I'm willing to do. So the idea of incorporating the patient voice in a meaningful way is really very, very important to advance the science. So we're very interested in enhancing the use of the patient experience through real-world data, and obviously advancing this oncology center to see it as a model for other diseases are really important priorities.
If you don't mind me turning the conversation a bit, how did you become an advocate?
My story is one that is not unusual for most patient advocates. My sister Gail died at age 40. It was a little over 30 years ago, and it was extraordinarily painful. She left a four-year-old daughter. I can never forget the day that I had to tell her daughter, a four-year-old, that her mother was dead, and it had a profound impact on my life and on her life and certainly on her daughter's life. I was angry. I was hurt. I was shocked. I started trying to help the cancer center, and it was very clear that not one individual, not one institution was ever going to really make a difference, and I became very involved. I was appointed to the National Cancer Advisory Board, and that's where I began to understand the importance of the federal investment in research. I was chair of the budget, and it started from understanding the infrastructure that we live in, understanding the science, and really understanding how much we didn't know and how much we needed to know, and frankly, the ability to just work together towards these goals. We all care about it. Everyone may have a different view on whether it's breast cancer or pancreatic or any disease, but we all have the urgency to get answers to patients. And it was very clear that being smart, being focused, and working with others that were able to help me tutor and for us to work with other groups towards these goals were important. No one individual can do it. It really has to be a collaboration. So I got there through a very painful experience, and I every day work with patients. I live in a scientific world that's highly technical, but I'll never forget and will never stay away from the actual individual patient that every day is desperate for answers to their disease. And I think that keeps me very grounded, focused, and continues to keep my passion.
What I've found about advocates is many times those that have business backgrounds and those who sort of have that ability to understand how things get done and to move mountains are the most successful. And you have that background. You've turned your passion for business and for history and other things toward moving mountains and patient advocacy. And it's really remarkable.
You know, it is interesting because I started as an academic and just by a series of circumstances became a business person and a real estate developer, but I always worked with the government. I always worked with the city government in D.C. and the national government on some of my major projects. And that was actually very good background of understanding how to work with, you know, citizen groups and how to work with the cities and how to work with architects towards creating better buildings. And also my Russian history background also. Maybe it's the suffering or maybe it's the creativity, but that was helpful. So I do think, even though I had zero background in science, the idea of getting things done and of getting things done in business and academics was very helpful, but it was really through the kindness of people that were willing to listen and working with others and understanding that you have to really collaborate and work with others to get this done. If you can't collaborate, and you should never discount people's intention on trying to help people. We all are in this together. At Friends of Cancer Research, we have an extraordinary team led by Jeff Allen. I'm very fortunate of the extraordinary dedication and resources that we have on our team at Friends and the leadership and friendship of Marlene Malik, our vice chair, over 20 years.
How have you been able to be persuasive regardless of the political party that happens to be in power here in Washington?
Democrat, Republican, rich, poor, we all have the same basic needs. And if you start to really deal with the idea that science is important and helping patients and get beyond politics, I think that there is a great camaraderie on supporting science. Some people view the regulatory environment through different lenses, but I think everyone wants to help patients. And I have my own views, but they're really not particularly relevant. What's really relevant is that we all have to work together. We're not going to solve this problem. And I think cures happen because passionate Democrats and passionate Republicans and passionate people work together. And there was bipartisan support. And when you get bipartisan support, you really help everyone. When you start to isolate people, that isn't going to accomplish anything. So regardless of other political views on issues, I find that Congress really truly, when they are passionate, they all have mothers, fathers, sisters, children, spouses that have disease that they want to help. And there are heroes. I started working with you with Arlen Specter. There was no one more passionate. There was no one more focused on helping patients and helping science. And I think that we're very lucky that we live in a world that understands how important it is, in a country that understands it. And that passion surrounds many. And you find few people that don't care about science or helping patients.
That's a wonderful note to end on, Ellen. Friends of Cancer Research and the work you've done there and your team have done there, a really wonderful team you've put together, have really moved mountains in getting therapies to patients.
And I remember how relentlessly you worked with Arlen Specter and Betty Lou, and how now that you continue to do such important work, and your background in science and your passion and your integrity and dignity, I'm very proud to call you a friend.
Thank you so much, Ellen. Thank you for your time today. And thank you to our listeners for listening in.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.